Everyone, this is Klaatu, and this is The Bad Apples, and I think it could possibly be episode 4. In this episode, we're going to interview a Linux user, a fairly new Linux user, named Rowing Golfer, whom a lot of you are probably going to recognize if you listen to Hacker Public Radio. He kind of made a name for himself, I guess, when he did a Hacker Public Radio episode, a spoof of the Security Now podcast. Very hilarious episode. But he and I talked for a little while about Linux, about programming, and about Chess Griffin. So let's listen to the interview and see what we both have to say for ourselves.
Hello?
Hey, Rowing Golfer, how's it going?
Oh, I'm glad to. Very well, thank you.
Cool.
Plug some headphones in here for this Skype thing, and it just comes through one ear. It's like listening to bloody Zoe. No, it's just right ear.
Well, I only speak in mono, so that's probably why.
I think I'm typical, but it would be, you know, it'd be nice to know, wouldn't it?
Yeah.
But I'm also asking, I guess I'm one of the new breed of users who is just using the fancy, you know, new GUI Linuxy desktopy things. And there's so many of us coming to it now who don't have a deeper understanding of what's going on under the hood that I think we're in a whole set of problems for the open source brigade.
Well, I mean, well, let's start there then. How long have you been using Linux? Because it sounds like you're kind of new to it.
Oh, yeah, very. I remember I think I was given, when the very first Ubuntu disk came out, I had some friends from Germany and Holland who gave me this thing. He says, oh, stick this in your computer, it's fantastic. And I stuck it in my computer and my screen went brown and nothing worked. I thought, well, I can do everything I want with Windows. What's all this about? Never really looked at it again until, I think, 6.06. And I've been scratching my brains to try and think why I tried it. But I remember just deciding that I was sick of Microsoft, just almost making a decision that I was going to leave Microsoft and I was going to use something else. And from that point on, never looked back, really.
What were the competitors when you were deciding to go away from Microsoft? Did you think about like going to the Mac or anything, or just you turned to Linux somehow?
I don't think I ever looked to buying new hardware. Mm. And that's the thing. That's the advantage with Macs, I guess. You can go into your high street store, pick up a Mac and away you go. I knew Macs had a good reputation, and probably if I was in the market for a new computer, I would have probably just bought one.
Yeah.
But I wasn't. I've got endless machines. I think I probably own around about 14 or 15 PCs.
Nice.
Yeah, and I'm one of these people who just wonders. I buy things because I buy on impulse. You know, I'll be in a shop, I'll say, oh, that looks nice, that's a nice color, that's a nice form factor. Buy it. Take it home and think, what the hell did I buy this for? What can I use it for?
Yeah.
So I found myself with a whole, you know, rake of hardware that I decided I needed to use, and the Mac option was out of the question. So that's why I didn't use Mac, and I've never used one. Although ironically, my mother's just bought one of these MacBook Airs.
Oh boy.
Oh well, she's. I think it'll be fine for her. I'm sure. Because again, she. All people need now is a web browser and an email client, isn't it? And,
yeah.
Get away with any. Your next question is going to be, why did I choose Ubuntu? I think I bought a Linux Journal or something along those lines off the shelf. And hell, those magazines are expensive, aren't they?
Yeah, I mean, I know, but they're like $18 over here. I don't know how much they are over there.
Probably about £6.
Yeah.
So we get a better deal than you, by the sound of it. Yeah, probably, yeah, £6, I guess. And yeah, I think one of the first copies I bought had an article by you in it, didn't it? And Spiderwick Chronicles on the front.
Oh, the Linux Journal. Yeah, that was the one that I was in. Yeah.
But no, so I bought this Ubuntu disk and put it on a computer, and it didn't work very well with that computer. This was a cheap supermarket Windows XP box, and the problems I was having is the graphics card was just I don't quite know, but it just couldn't take the correct refresh rate for the monitor I was using, and there were lines going across it. Frequently, and I was, you know, Googling, and you know, I was a reasonably competent Windows user. So I knew my way around Google. I was trying to Google, find out exactly what hardware I've got, what these problems were, and realized quite early on that other people were having exactly the same issue. Mm-hmm. So I think that was the first sea change. I then realized that if you're going to adopt this open source operating system, you've got to be much choosier about the hardware you get. Overnight, I stopped doing the sort of flash purchase with the credit card every time I went into a PC World or a Dixon's, which are our high street stores here. And
that's kind of a side benefit of going open source, I guess.
Yeah, absolutely. Absolutely. And the other thing is, once you've got something working under open source, you know that it's going to work for years to come.
Yeah.
If I may, I'll just tell you the problems I was having with the Microsoft thing.
Yeah, I'm interested because I've never used anything Microsoft. Like, I've never used Windows, and I'm interested in hearing like what exactly the problems were.
I think on Linux Cranks the other week, Zoke brought up the fact that Microsoft is the number two trusted brand in the UK.
Yeah, I heard.
Yeah, and I was one of those people. I thought, right, do you know the certifications that used to flash up, always trust something from Microsoft? Well, you wouldn't if you haven't used it, but, you'd say when they're installing things, you say, don't show me this again, always trust Microsoft, etc. I was one of the people who just, Microsoft, that's great. I trust them implicitly, And I think if you're using a Microsoft machine, you have to have that mentality because, it's going to be updating every second Tuesday, et cetera, et cetera. And if you don't trust the operating system, the damn thing's a liability. But I trusted Microsoft to the extent that I also had a pocket PC that was Microsoft going back to 2000 or so. And then I bought a second one of those and I bought a Windows CE mobile phone. I've always been interested in programming devices. And I thought, right, my next, My next hobby is going to be I'm going to learn to program these things. Cool. Because I used to program back when I was sort of 13 or 14, in BASIC on what was called the BBC Micro, which was an Acorn machine. That had a version of BASIC, which was effectively an interactive shell. Now, I didn't realize it at the time. These are all new terminologies. And when you logged in, it gave you a prompt, and you could start typing line numbers, and they would be stored into memory, and then you could run that program. So it's very similar to sort of the Python interactive shell now. So I did some programming, and then computers just they became secretaries for God knows how many years, didn't they? They were in the 90s. You could do word processing on them and play Lemmings. I had no interest. So between 1990 and 1999 or so, I didn't touch a PC. And then, as I say, I became this Microsoft advocate, buying everything, ripping all my CDs onto Windows Media, star.wmv format. Right. And I built a big library, and I say, always tick the box. Yeah, I don't mind. If this is legitimate music, I'm going to accept this, burn it onto, store it in my library as WMV files and file my licenses, etc., etc. And then I bought another computer, and I thought, right, I'll just transfer all those files across and play them. And they didn't play. And I realized that. I thought, well, that's Microsoft making bloody decisions. They're assuming I'm a criminal.
Right.
They're assuming that I've downloaded all this music legitimately. And so that was an annoyance. And then, as I say, I wanted to program this phone, so I bought the Visual Studio stuff. And it gets to a point where it's $2,500 just to get to keep updating that software so that you can program to a phone. And it's not that I begrudge the money. It's just that the fact that everything you do on these machines becomes obsolete as, their next set of developers comes in, they ignores everything the previous ones have done, and there's no continuity.
Yeah.
So I think that was really the last straw, was I'd done all this programming for the .NET 1.1 framework on my computer. I wrote I'm a rowing golfer on the forums because I'm quite a keen rower, and I'd written a bit of software for timing processional races in rowing that worked on the PC as a sort of a database and worked on the phone.
Oh, cool.
As a timer. Yeah, it was great, but I couldn't support it. I just couldn't support it because they moved to Visual Studio, whatever, which didn't support the version of .NET that I had I'd trained myself up in, and so I thought, sod you, I'm going to turn my back and got into Linux, bought this Linux Journal, popped the disk in, and then thought, right, I need to find out more about this, and that's where I came across the Linux Reality podcast.
Cool.
With Jess Griffin, which really just that was such a great introduction. And as I say, I think I made the decision to really stick to Linux at that point, but that just really cemented it. And I remember listening to the first few episodes, and I thought, I've done it again. I've made a bad choice. I've chosen the wrong system here. He's talking about, I think episode 2 or 3 or 4. We're installing a PC Linux OS.
Yeah.
Is that Is that, that's a distro,
yeah? Yep, it is. And that was the first one that he reviewed.
Yeah, and I thought, oh, bollocks, I've put the wrong one in. I'm going to have to start again. As it pans out, I think sort of a few shows in, he sort of reviewed Ubuntu, and he gave such an in-depth, low-level introduction to Linux that I realized that, you know, I was on the right track.
I mean, obviously, you did a great job. So the programming stuff that you were doing in .NET, I'm just curious, did you have to pay like a... You had to pay for all that, like the software to develop, correct? That you don't get the ability to use .NET without paying, or do you?
You know, I live in quite a remote part of Scotland, and there's not many high-level computer users around here. Not that I've met. I may be wrong. And to computers, as I say, when 20-odd years ago, they were machines that you could do what you programmed to do what you wanted them to
right.
do. That's not the case now at all. And Microsoft Windows in particular, I realize now, but didn't realize then, it's just an atrocious developer's platform. I've got about four or five shelves full of programming books upstairs. You know, I tried C, I tried all these other things, and just banging my head against the wall because the basic operating system doesn't have any tools to help you develop upon it.
Well, you know, that's interesting because neither does Mac OS X without extra stuff to install. I was encountering the same thing while I was trying to get more into the programming side and sort of under... You know, inside of that whole Unix thing that they keep talking about, I was finding that they don't make it easy on you.
Once you start trying to get into graphical programming, it seems a mess right across the board, frankly. But as a newbie, if you say I want to write, a newbie talking about myself, I wanted to write a graphical application. You know, I was looking at it completely the wrong way round. Really, I was thinking, right, I want to have a button, and when I press it, I want this to happen, as opposed to trying to define a good set of logic, define all the algorithms first, and then put something at the top. If anything, my experience with Visual Studio on Microsoft reinforced that. If you fire that up and say, right, start a new project, the first thing it does is say, right, here's your form, design your form. And it presents you with something which is not dissimilar to something like the Qt Designer or something like Glade.
Yeah, yeah. Like an interface builder.
That's right. So it actually encourages you to start that way, which is fine. As I say, I wrote programs which I'm quite proud of, but the underlying code is an absolute shambles because it's it always starts from the high level objects and then puts low. It's wrong. If I'd been mentored and I'd been able to sort of say right in 92, 93, when I started doing this programming, if I had somebody who'd got a clue, who had said to me, and I'd been able to explain to them what I was trying to achieve, I think he would have said to me, right, you need a developer's platform, which is not Windows, and you need to start with a sensible language, and a good one to start with would be something like Python, which is the other, as well as listening to Jess Griffin, the other podcast I grabbed hold of was Ron Stevens' Python 411 podcast. So I had the whole back catalogue of Linux Reality to listen to and the whole of this Python 411 to listen to. And I just went off on holiday to Cyprus and just dumped myself and listened to the whole thing.
That's great.
Listened to both of them. It just threw all the terminology at me and meant that I could probably bluff my way reasonably well. Although I'm still every day coming up against barriers to what I'm trying to achieve with these things.
Well, I'm sure that's going to alleviate itself once you get even better at it, I'm sure.
Oh, absolutely. I'm now at the point of, set up a, thanks to, the home server aspect that Chess had suggested, I've got a Mythbox running and I've got a Slug running Debian. What a Windows power user can do coming to Linux is just phenomenal.
Yeah, it really is. And I think you make a good point actually about like how computers faded into like this kind of doldrums during the 90s. Because I mean, mm-hmm. I know that I think it's DistroWatch's little motto on the site is like put the, use Linux and FreeBSD, put the fun back into computing, and it's so true. It's like you get into that stuff and suddenly you're like, oh, I remember why I ever got into computers in the first place, because it actually can be quite cool, like when you're discovering new things and finding out new ways of doing really cool things.
If I look at my sort of colleagues around me now who are stuck in the Windows mold, all they're doing is playing with photos and changing the CD collection over and fanning about on iTunes and all this business. And I just feel that we've got all those things on Linux, but we've got so much more as well. And I've become quite passionate about the computing again and really enjoy it, probably as much now as I did when I was 13 and 14, when, you know, I could quite easily just do an all-nighter on the BBC Micro, just writing stuff.
Yeah, I know exactly what you mean. Have a, and I'm not sure, but I mean, I know that one of your Hacker Public Radio episodes was on OpenDNS, and I think you were talking about how you used that at work or something. Is that correct?
Yep.
So is this a, do you have a, a business of your own?
Yeah, I'm not too ashamed to tell you. I'm a dentist.
Ah.
And, we use, I have to use Windows there at work. In fact, one of the networks is still running Windows 98. And believe it or not, it's a DOS program that's being ported to that. That network is, it never touches anything else, and it runs flawlessly.
Right. Yeah, and you're using that, I'm assuming, because there's like software related to the dentist business or practice that needs to run on that.
Yeah. And then I've set up a second network there, which is more under my own control, which is for the media and photography and video side of things. So we end up in every surgery, we've got the kind of the gas powered old Windows 98 box, and then we've got another network at the side of it, which is still sadly running XP, but on the network which I've set up, and that's going quite well. We've got there's a really essential bit of proprietary software that we have to run on that, which is for the older patient X-rays. But I would love to move that away from Microsoft, because what I worry about there is that data is vendor locking. Say, I think in the practice we've probably got about 6,000 or 7,000 patients, and when you consider the database that we're building up on those and the obligations that we have with that data to be tied to some tin pot company who could well not be there tomorrow, is quite frightening, because ultimately I'm going to be responsible there. Heaven only knows where that's going to lead. So I that's something I should really pull finger on and try and try and protect. But it's I think the underlying database is there. It's still MySQL, and I'm able to back it up quite sensibly. But as I say, if the overlying program ever gets corrupted or lost, I think I'm in trouble.
Yeah, wow, that's crazy. That's yet another good argument for the free software stuff.
Yeah, no, there is an open source dental, a whole practice management software suite, but it's a .NET thing on Windows, and it's called Open Dental, and it's a US program, which is a bit, you know, it's got slightly different needs for us, where we've got NHS contractual obligations and this kind of stuff. So open source is beginning to make inroads there as well. And, on my to-do list, once I've got a bit more of a clue, I might see what we can do about bringing that in. Because I'm paying probably about £3,000 a year just to kind of support the software that we've got running. When I'm not entirely happy with it and not able to, you know, as I say, it absolutely restricts my freedoms and gives me liabilities. I would love to abandon it.
Yeah, the Linux Format magazine had a article about a pub owner in I think London who basically wrote his own software for his till, and he had like a database of all the, I guess, the beer or whatever in the basement, you know, versus what's on tap or whatever. I mean, I don't really know that much about pubs, but you know, he had like a really nice system going. It was all Linux based. It was pretty, it was an interesting article.
But see, lots of people are using Linux, aren't they? In applications where they don't even realize they're doing it. You know, all these, I've got a TomTom in the car driving around, and I think sometimes we lose the plot a little bit when we're just being Linux advocates, because that's just not a message that's going to get across, is it? You know, and trying to get people to use Linux is not the end game, I don't think. If someone's driving around with a TomTom in their car, that's as proprietary as everything, and their business model is not ultimately not as user friendly as it should be either.
Right.
So,
well, then what do you think the end game is?
It's a very good question. That's what I'm saying. I think people like myself who come into this and find this very mature graphical Linux desktop situation, it's very confusing for us to realize, you know, to try and work out exactly how we've got to where we are. The Randall Swartz discussions that were over on Tilts recently.
Oh, were there Randall Swartz discussions on Tilts? I didn't know.
Yeah. you know, I think it was Pat who was bitching about the fact that Twit is just very Windows-centric. And for a podcast that claims to be about everything good in technology, not to mention Linux at all, it's just wrong.
Really, it's inexcusable, because they're ignoring... Well, like you say, everyone's using Linux. They practically don't even realize that they are. But I mean, there's Linux in all kinds of things, even if it's just embedded Linux. You know, it's just everywhere.
Yeah, but So Randall Swartz came in, and I think he started participating in the forums, and that I made a couple of points in that thread, which pushed it towards the just trying to explain that I just don't understand the business model. I don't understand the open source business model at all. But he, I think, has let the Linux community down by his statement on Twit about not running Linux on anything important.
Oh, yeah, of course.
Because, I still don't think he realizes that sent a message out there that Linux isn't good enough for anything important.
Yeah.
And mission-critical applications are already in use. And, I think, air traffic control and, all these traffic devices. And, we're already there, but the message just isn't getting home. And the advocacy for free software, we've got people like Stallman who are just an absolute turnoff. You know, I mean, I really appreciate what the guy stands for, but he's never gonna come across as anything other than the guy at the end of the street with the end of the world is nice sticker around his neck. You know, nobody listens to an angry man who's and I think people like myself who've come to it later, this stage, just find the whole model confusing, and it's difficult to see how somebody like myself, who's already spending a lot of money on IT, both personally and commercially, how we can make sure that that's channeled into the right direction, so that we're not going to perpetuate this awful status quo that we've developed.
Yeah, well, I mean, I don't know much about business or economics or anything like that, but it just seems to me, in my very basic understanding, that if the software was free software, it would basically be able to improve and be improved upon itself, but people are still going to be making purchases of one thing or another, whether it's just the hardware, because that's not going to become free, obviously, or maybe they'll be buying the service to be trained on the software, which is really it's basically how I make a lot of my living, is training people on software that I know that they do not know, and that's a very valid method of employment. And that software could very well be open source. I mean, it happens to be not the stuff that I train people on, but, I don't get any money from the fact that they've bought, Final Cut Pro or whatever, but I certainly get money from training them. And I think a lot of people could, I don't think people are going to be out of business because people aren't paying for this proprietary software that they have no way of saying, hey, this really needs to change, this needs to improve, or, accessing their data after they decide to switch platforms and all the other stuff that's evil about proprietary. So for whatever that means in terms of like a business model, I think that's I could see how that could work.
Definitely, making hardware that works, and works well and compatibly, and shares its specifications so that the open source developers can use it to its full potential. That's great. That's the way it should be. And more information can perpetuate through. It's just ideal. Another thing. As I say, I've listened to a whole back catalogue of podcasts. There was a very good interview with Eric Raymond on Tilts.
I haven't heard that one.
Well, one of the statements he made, he says, I'm going to say something outrageous here, is that perfectly designed software shouldn't need a manual.
That's cool.
And it's a statement that takes some time to absorb.
Yeah.
If the user interface was so intuitive that anybody could use it right out of the box.
I've seen some pretty dumb users, though.
Well, indeed. I mean, you say close your windows, they get up, they close the windows.
Yeah.
So it's a tough call. But the difficulty I have there is that if we're going to move towards a support model, but we're also moving to an open source software design model where the software becomes better and better designed and more, and the best features of one are freely available to be taken into another. So the whole computer experience becomes more homogenous.
Right.
If software is good, there's less demand for support.
Yeah, I guess.
Does that make
sense? Yeah, I mean, I totally. I mean, if you're gonna go with what Eric Raymond says about great software being really easy to use and stuff. I wonder about all the users' ability to do it. Plus, I also just kind of wonder about, I mean, there are people out there who just cannot troubleshoot. Like, I know maybe it is a great software, but what happens when they close something and they forgot to save it? Sure, maybe there's a cached version of it. You know how Vim and some other, I think K-Write, they make like automatic backups for you. But how do they restore from that? You know, or whatever might go wrong, or what happens when their internet goes down and they need to figure out how to get their IP address, turned back on or something, like their dynamic, you know, if something goes wrong with their router. Whatever. I think there's going to be an opportunity for support, and there's always going to be opportunities for custom improvements of software that, you know, not everyone's going to – I'm not a developer yet. You know, if I needed someone to write a certain thing for me in Blender and I need it right now, you know, and I was doing this for a business, I know that I would pay for someone to customize that software for me.
Perfect coffee, sending its glow into our lives around the clock. It helps us start the day with warmth and vigor. It is a pleasant spur to the morning's work. It provides the essential part of our pause at noon, indispensable during that unhurried hour in a world that often forgets to stop. In the romance of evening, when young dreams glow softly, coffee is always a perfect companion. And after dinner, it is at home in any setting when good taste is important. In the end, it remains a simple thing. Easy to attain, well made, and well enjoyed. A good cup of good coffee.
I think sometimes when you know, we Linux advocates get together, and I went to, I threw myself in at the deep end. I went to the Log Radio Live conference. Oh, cool. A couple of weeks ago, and I expected to feel out of place, but geez, it was a really, really just great atmosphere and very inclusive, and everybody was just open, full stop. Yep. You know, that's the only word you can use.
Yeah, no, I found the same thing, and I know that some people have had bad experiences, you know, with certain groups being exclusive or being, you know, lewd and vulgar or whatever, but I find the people that I've encountered so far very, very helpful and very open. I'm very impressed with the community as it is from what I see of it.
Take my golfing history, if you like. You know, if I was to invite you to my golf club, you'd probably think, "Oh, crumbs, what am I going to wear?
Right.
How am I going to fit?" Whereas if you were to write to the golf club, you'd expect to get quite a courteous response.
Sure.
I think that what I've seen of the open source community is absolutely that. Turned on its head. If you join a chat room on any of the Linux forums and speak out of place, you'll quite quickly get slapped down. You know. So what I'm saying is that the sort of textual approach. If I send an email to Richard Stallman saying I want to try this Linux thing, you know exactly what's
yeah.
good. You know, I'm going to get
yeah.
an answer. So I think often you know what we find is that the open source users are quite abrupt. And a textual format, but I wasn't sure. You know, I thought when I step in there, am I going to get that same kind of harshness that difficult to associate yourself with these people? But it was just completely the opposite. You could have walked in there wearing anything, I thoroughly enjoyed it.
Or nothing at all.
Indeed. Well, they had a guy in a thong hitting a gong at one point. I'm very pleased to say I missed that.
Yeah, probably a good thing. So you're. Your first Hacker Public Radio episode was on was called Security Wow, which turned out to be probably the most hilarious thing I've heard in a long time. What were you thinking?
If you remember, I came into the Lotta Linux Links IRC room and you know just tentatively just said. Hi, guys. I don't mean to interrupt. Please ignore me if I'm in the wrong. And I think I didn't get anything other than Edan shouting at me, clear off, you haven't got a clue. You know. I took that at heart initially. I thought, gosh, what's happening? But then, I persisted, because I'm not really scared of being ridiculed. You know, I'm big enough and ugly enough to know that, you know, one person doesn't make a bad trend. Right. And you and Zoke were in there, and I said, listen, I've got this idea for a Hacker Public, a Hacker Public radio episode. I said, I'm a fan of Security Now, and I know that's not very cool, and I know that no one listens to it anymore or claims they don't listen to it anymore. What do you think? And I think between us all, we devised a script, and I was hoping that somebody with some voiceover skills or somebody who had at least had an accent in the right ballpark would take it on and run with it.
But in the end, it was so funny with you doing both parts, no less. That was so hilarious.
Well, I'll tell you, this is an interesting thing. I wanted to actually just find out what the Security Now listeners thought. So I joined their forum, and I went in there and said, listen, some wag on Hacker Public Radio has put this episode up. And, you know, I just thought that I think I said it's a little bit puerile in parts, but some of it seems reasonably well observed. What do you guys think? And of course, it led to some of them came back and said, "Oh, those two guys." I thought, "Hang on, two. How could they not know it's just one person?" So, "Oh, those two guys sound off the trolley." And then Steve Gibson weighed in, and he eventually listened to it and says, "Oh, I think that's the most hilarious thing I've ever seen." And he forwarded it on to some of his friends and family, apparently. And He went up in my estimation a huge amount because he just, you know, took it all on the chin.
Absolutely,
and
yeah, that's really cool. That's neat that he did that.
I wasn't really having a pot at him so much as the whole. I think Leo Laporte I've never seen him on the television or any of these things that he has done in the past. Now, I don't know anything about what he, you know, his persona over in the States or how well known he is or what a celebrity is. I think he certainly pushed the podcasting genre onto new heights overall. To try and make a living from that, it just shows it's like what we were discussing earlier, you know, to have a sort of a free product and yet still make money from it puts one on behind your back and begins to twist, and you there are forces at work there which are not always pushing in the same direction. So it was it was an easy target just to have a go at, you know, Steve's over enthusiasm and Leo, you know, just grabbing money wherever he can.
I think when I heard it, I wasn't sure if it was one guy or two guys as well, and I eventually caught on that it was just one guy. I think I remember the crack that your Steve said, you humans have the need to like do something or other. That was so funny.
Yeah, I can't remember that line. So yeah, you humans don't understand statistics at all.
You humans, that cracked.
Well, that's right. Because the week before he'd mentioned the Twin Towers, and he'd mentioned the Twin Towers, and saying that the probability of it happening was very small, but it was still a probability and a possibility. And you could hear Leo Laporte at the other end thinking, "Is this really an appropriate subject to be talking about?" So I thought, right, I'll pick up on it. Throw it in. And he does sometimes I think Steve does sometimes seem a little bit above it all, doesn't he?
I don't know. I could never get through one of the episodes. I tried. I think someone mentioned that podcast and I tried it and I just found it extremely boring. But
yeah. The odd thing is, I mean, I think sometimes it's the relationship between the two of them made it, you know, I found it enjoyable. I've listened to them all and continue to do so. And I know, you know, Pat thinks that Steve Gibson's a bit of a Linux basher, but I don't think he is particularly. I think he's just old school, and he's just using computers for what he, he's trying to service his clients, and his clients are all using Windows, and that's fine.
Right.
Then asked to do a second one, and you know, did the Open DNS thing. And I suppose, you know, I didn't realize at the time, but that was quite a timely thing to discuss with what's happened recently.
I know, isn't that funny? When I did my dynamic DNS episode, the same thing. I hadn't actually heard about the whole the DNS problem yet, and so that was pretty interesting.
Well, I don't think we've heard the last of it, and it amazes me that the mainstream media just haven't really caught on to what a big problem that could be.
I'm surprised that they haven't mentioned it. I really am.
Quite, because, you know, they warn about phishing sites and clicking on links and always check that it says, you know, Bank of America at the top, and it's still gonna do that, and people are gonna get fooled.
Yeah, absolutely. There's been this. You know, these reports lately, I don't know if you've seen them, but reports online of Chess Griffin sightings.
Oh.
I don't know if I believe them or not, but apparently some people, you know, have seen him here and there, just random places. You heard of any sightings yourself lately?
Oh, I think you're aware of this, but I I think someone on the IRC compared him to Elvis, and that gave me an idea. You know, Edan always claims people are dead to him.
Right.
Somebody discusses, someone dismisses him, or hasn't turned up, or hasn't produced a podcast. I think you know, Dave Yates went on holiday.
Right.
Edan declared him dead. But with Chess Griffin, it was a bit more poignant because the guy had just, you know, he'd been, well, for me, at least, you know, he'd been a huge part of my weekly life, and then bang, off he goes. You did an interview with him, and I think you were about the last person to see him alive before he went in his hiatus.
Yeah, it was sad.
I think that's why I started listening to the Bad Apples, actually, because I thought, oh, here we go. I can get my chest fixed. As soon as somebody said on the IRC, or it's like Elvis being dead, you know, we're going to start having Chess Griffin sign. As soon as I heard that, I thought, right, there's some fun to be had with this. And one thing that I had done on Linux is I tried Slackware. Slackware was just way too hard for me. I got it installed, got it running, couldn't get it working with my wireless, so basically ditched it.
Yeah.
But the one thing I really liked about Slackware was every time you opened a shell, it came up with these lovely little quotes.
Yeah, the message of the day, that's great.
And I think a couple of weeks later, I'd mentioned, I really loved Slackware, the way it gave you those quotes every day. And someone said, well, stick Fortune in Bash RC, and you'll get... I said, what? And it was already installed on Ubuntu, just not up and running. And then I think Kajari pointed out to me just the other week, if you put a minus O tag after it, it gives you the obscene ones, or minus A, it gives you a bigger mix. And so I've now got that even on Ubuntu. So the one thing I liked about Slackware, I've managed to get running on Ubuntu, which is I'm ashamed, because I would have loved to have been able to run Slackware. That would be real street cred, but.
It's a great system, but yeah, it does require a little bit of work starting out.
But I replaced it just for a few weeks there. I wrote my own little script that was called Chess Sightings. I wrote it in Python, and what that did is every time I opened a shell, it just banged out to the net and trawled. There's a Elvis Sightings website, and it would just pull that off. Pull off the latest sighting and replace any words such as the King or Elvis or Elvis Presley with either Chess Griffin or, you know, the Podmaster or something like that. And it was just really, every time I opened a shell, I'd get this different sighting of Chess. And God, he was all over the planet. He was eating, he was frying burgers in Southampton one day, and I enjoyed it. I would have liked to have done something more with that. It would have been quite funny if we'd been able to hack Lynn on the London Linux Lynx IRC, we could have had her seeing Chess every hour or so.
Yeah, we should do that. We should suggest that to Dave Yates. I'm going to post that script on the Bad Apple site, and all five people who visit that site are going to know that it's there and possibly download it. Maybe not use it, but possibly download it.
Well, do it. It's quite good. There were quite a few little hacks to get that working, actually, because the sighting site, again, I don't know how they raise their money, but they always make a note of the referrer. So I had to make it look as though it had come from within the site for the link to work. I tell you, if anybody does take that script and run with it and improve it, I'd love to know what they do with it.
Is the license the Microsoft.net license? Is that what you've...
let's call it public domain, shall
okay.
we? That has problems as well, but who cares? Who cares? Of course, you can replace. You can replace. Whoever you decide to be dead that day, you can replace the name with them, can't you? Has anyone seen? When you go on holiday, we'll have Clatoo sightings.
Right.
Could be.
I
good,
don't take holidays.
Yeah. No, well, you Americans don't. In general,
we want to, but we for some reason we don't.
See, I think we in Britain, we have some sort of American, we have some aspects of American culture and some aspects of European, and we take more holidays than you, but not as many as some of the Europeans. You know, they really do public holidays really well, and some parts of Europe are off for a month at the moment, I understand. You know, closed for a month. They say, well, everyone take the same holiday, but we're not going to run at 80% capacity, we're just going to close, and then we'll see you all again in a month.
Oh, that's great.
We're more about the individual in Britain, as I understand you are over there.
Oh, man, we are, as far as I can tell, we're all about the individual. It's that whole rugged, you know, cowboy mentality.
Yeah, well, I'm visiting the States in October.
Oh, no way. Are you going to Ohio Linux Fest?
Oh, I would love to. I mean, I'm thinking I'm going, it's Florida.
Oh,
we're taking the kids to Disney.
Oh, cool.
I might see if I can escape and go into Ohio. I have no idea of geography. It's probably thousands of miles apart.
It would be, it's a... that's a long way. So what okay. what languages do you know? Python and I guess what is .NET a language, or is that just the framework and that we're using C sharp or what?
Yeah, it's the C sharp is their sort of Java ripoff language, isn't it? And by the time I got to .NET, it was Visual Basic. Okay. I didn't see many things you could achieve in C sharp that you couldn't achieve in Visual Basic, but Visual Basic had a sort of a stigma attached to it as being the baby language. It really pissed me off that actually. I bought you buy a book about how to write to program Microsoft Windows, and you realize that you're not programming the Windows APIs at all. It's all this layer on top. And someone told me at the time to get into Java, and I probably would have been slightly better off. It's going to be interesting to see where Java goes now. That's all opened up. No, so I know VB.NET, although I've probably forgotten most of that. I learned a little bit of C. I've learned a little bit of assembly language just to try and work out exactly what's happening down at the programming level.
Oh, wow, that's cool.
Yeah, no, right. Well, I think you've. I don't think you need to learn assembly language, but I think you need to just realize just how few calls are actually being made when you write a program. And then, yeah, there's a little bit of C, which actually I found really quite enjoyable. I think that's probably not a bad choice for people to start on. And then Python, which just does everything. That's great. You know, it's so easy just to, you can use it for websites, you can use it for GUIs. It's great.
I like Python a lot. And, I'm having a good time learning.
Oh, it answers my need. You know, the difficulty is, you know, a hobby programmer. You can't be a hobby programmer using the .NET set of languages. I don't see, because you've got to always be purchasing the next Visual Studio, and I have to say there's quite a good community out there, people helping, and they've got this Microsoft Most Valued Person kind of badge that they give to people who help out on the forums, etc. And it's not a bad community, sure. But the Python community just rips it apart. I'd love to do more with Python and maybe put something back in at some point into that. You know, so I do have a goal to try and get. You know, there's the Java Posse podcast where it's just three or four guys talking about Java. I would love to try and see some more podcasts which are a little bit more specific.
Yeah, me too, actually. You know, I mean, that Python 411, I always thought it sounded like a good idea, although I need to check his back catalog again, I think, because the ones that I heard didn't seem to have any clear focus. But maybe I was just listening to the wrong shows.
He started off really well. And he did one of his first programs. He would just talk about the data structures. He'd say, right, I'm going to talk about dictionaries. and he'd get his high pitch. And he'd say, dictionaries are really cool. And bang on about that. And they were great. You know, that was what you needed. His enthusiasm was really infectious. Yeah. And then I think the worst possible thing happened is he got a couple of real experts to come in and do one or two guest episodes. Mm. You know, there was one guy who did how Python runs and spoke about PyPy and CPython and really got quite gritty and excellent, informative podcast. But from there on in, Ron Stevens never seemed to kind of grab hold of it again. He seemed to be much more self-conscious, and it dried up. And although, believe it or not, he's released two episodes in the last 2 days.
Oh, okay.
Having not done a podcast for 3 months. Yeah. And I would like to see some developers actually making podcasts about what they do. But developers are... Developers are developed. They just sit around and all they want to do is code. But what we need is somebody who's got an ability to actually talk about what they do as well as do it, as well as actually spend a lot of time working underneath this. And I think the only way you can get the real hardcore coders out of their happy little environment, get them away from the keyboard for a bit, is some sort of regular round table talk. And maybe a Python talk show or something like that would be great.
That could be cool.
Yeah. So if there's anyone out there who's listening and would like to get that started, do it. I'm not going to help you. Just do it on your own.
Exactly.
And I will say right now that I will listen to you.
Yes, and I will promote it.
Pat, he says that programming Java is a main part of
That's
his...
That's what I thought, yeah, yeah.
Yeah, and he's dabbling with Python now. I think he's going to be up to speed really, really quickly. He's already, talking about things way above my understanding. Wow. He's investigated all the GUI toolkits already and made a choice.
Wow.
And, he knows about all the class inheritances, etc. So maybe he's the guy who's going to, get it up and running.
That would be fantastic. We should hint towards that. I don't know. Maybe he'll hear this episode and take a hint.
Yeah. Well, the other guy I think who might be very, very good at this is there's an IDE for Python called Stanis Python Editor.
Yeah.
It's in the Ubuntu repos. I think it's just SPE. If you apt-get install SPE, you can have a look at it. And it's quite clever. It uses Vim, I think, as the text editor. Nice. And it just seamlessly has a Python interactive shell running and it's good. And the reason I mention that is I've just at Lug Radio Live, there's a guy called Ed. I forget his surname now. I think it might be Ed Harvey, who is the programmer behind PTV.
Oh, nice.
Video editing application. And he also hacks away on the GStreamer framework. And I've been just having a look at the code of that project and hanging out in their IRC a little bit. And it's just been awarded Google Summer of Code money.
Oh, very cool.
Yeah, so they've got a couple of students working on it and branching it out and trying different things. But this guy, Stanny, appeared in there a couple of days ago and said, oh, by the way, I've made a little frame-seeking tool. I just wondered if you'd consider incorporating it because it would be useful for what I want to use PTV for. And he gave a link to a bizarre branch that he'd made. And I opened it up and had a look at the code. And it is just... This code, if anybody wants to, maybe we could put a link in the show notes to this code, because if anyone is a Python hacker, the code that he's written, you know, this is a guy who's written his own, IDE, so it's pretty proficient.
Yeah.
The code is just gorgeous. It shows you exactly how to write a beautifully structured, modular set of Python.
Wow.
Text files, but also put the kind of init bits in the right folders. And what's even more awesome is that he's using two or three different toolkits, GUI toolkits. He said, use whichever one you want. And his code is just so well separated from this GUI layer. He's done it for WX Windows and also for GTK.
Wow.
It is exemplary. Not only that, the application runs seamlessly as well. So
PTV is not all in Python, though, right? Or is it?
Yes, it is. It's all Python.
Unbelievable. But
it uses the underlying GStreamer,
right?
To do all of its sort of complex video editing.
You know what?
So
do you have any idea why there's not like MPlayer based? Do you have any understanding of what GStreamer is exactly? I mean, I would always think, if I were going to go out and do something with video editing, I would just somehow use MPlayer to do that. But I don't. Maybe that's just not how it works.
I don't know a lot about the GStreamer thing. Ironically enough, John, there's a very good tutorial by John O'Bacon a couple of years ago about how to use GStreamer. From the command line, just to play a video an MP3 file or an OGG file.
Oh, I didn't know that. Okay.
And then he shows you how to write the little sort of GUI application for it. And it's a first-class tutorial. I was never a big John O'Bacon fan, but I found this thing a couple of days ago. I think it's just exactly how to write a tutorial, and it's a useful subject.
You know what? Send me that link and send me the link to the PTV code so I can include both.
Yep, I'll do that. I'll do that.
That sounds very cool. PTV is an exciting project. I am. I don't like that model of video editing with the single viewer window that doubles as your viewer in your canvas. But I'm just a picky.
Yeah.
I'm a picky video editor because it's what I do for a living most of the time. But I do like the project, and it's important, obviously, to be to have a really solid little program for video editing.
It's an attractive application for me. Is I've just bought a new camcorder, which actually just records straight to MPEG on the little memory stick within it. And it's an HD camcorder, but I'm just using it on standard def settings. And you can get 90 minutes on a 4 gig memory stick. And what that does, I've just been back from Italy, and I've got about 130 video files, which I want to do is, join them together, maybe clip the front of the end off, put a couple of transitions in, and send it to DVD.
Right.
And the format is already DVD compatible. It's AC3 audio, and it's you're the codec master, but I believe the video is already 16:9. It's the correct format for my screen, and as I say, it's definitely an MPEG already, and it plays fine all I want to do is just dump it on a DVD, and I just can't do it. I just can't do it. I remember asking that question in the IRC, and you know, you suggested Lives. I had some fun with that, and I had and Kinos, very good, but all of these things want to translate it to something else before you can edit it and then change it back, and I just think that's messy.
I just did, I would, you should never have to convert before you edit. That's a big pet peeve of mine. I can't stand that. I mean, it's just not, it shouldn't have to be done. I just did a little tutorial on how to edit just really basic editing in Blender. I'll send you that link, actually, because it might actually work for you if that's all you want to do.
Yeah, it may well do.
I don't know. You have anything else to advertise or try to sell, or you want to give your dental practices website out or anything?
Definitely not. No, just everybody... Rowing is, if there's any young guys out there going to university, try rowing. It's a great, great sport. It attracts beautiful, healthy females. You get to see them in the Lycra, and the sport is about 50-50% male, female. Great athletic endeavor for university. And not all golfers are squat there. That's all I have to say.
Contribution to Linux reality at this point, when Jess Griffin announced that he was going to end his show, I said that I was thinking about creating a mirror for the show so that just in case, for whatever reason, his Libsyn account or whatever he's hosting it on goes away or just whatever, at least they would be available elsewhere on the interweb. And so what I've done is I just set up this little free hosting account at a place called myhosting247 and 247.com. And I've posted all of the MP3 files and all the AUG versions of the show, episode 1 through 100, on this web server. And so I'm still working on the main page of it to make it really easy to use. But for now, it is located at linuxreality.myhosting247.com. Now, obviously, this is just basically a backup system. That's how I view it. I just thought it was a little bit precarious to just have it all located on one site. I don't know. I mean, I'm sure that most of us have copies of the show. If anything ever went wrong with this site or something, we would all be able to pull together and recreate episode 1 through 100. But since I just had them, I burned them to a disk anyway, so I figured, well, why not take that off the disk and put it online as well so that other people could have access to it if they needed to. So it's there, it's available, it's just another way of getting the show. It's really just for backup. Obviously, I would continue going to linuxreality.com, refer people to linuxreality.com. This isn't meant to replace linuxreality.com. Linuxreality.com has the forums there, and it's got I'm sure that if anyone's tracking the downloads and stuff like that, then that would be very handy to have through the linuxreality.com site. But know that there is a backup copy of all that stuff at linuxreality.myhosting247.com. And I think that's about it. Thanks for listening. My email address is gort.klaatu@gmail.com. That is gort.klaatu@gmail.com. You can also find me in IRC, usually in the channel Hash Podcast, or Hash Linux Cranks, or Hash A Lot of Linux Links. So hit me up if you want to. Name's Klaatu. Can't miss me. Thanks for listening to the show, and be sure to come back next week. Got more good tutorials and stuff like that coming up.